Welcome, everyone, to St. Paul's and this Faith and Justice Lunch, and we're really glad you're here. Clearly, this is something people want to talk about, and so we are excited. I'm going to give you a little introduction as to what we're going to do and how we're going to do it and a little bit of why we're going to do it. But first, I'd like to pray. In the Anglican tradition, which we are a part, we begin prayers by saying, "The Lord be with you," and then there's a response that is, "And also with you." So if you're Episcopalian, you know that. If you're visiting, now you know that too. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. Creator God, it is good to be together on this day. We thank you for the time that you have made for each of us to attend and be in this place. We thank you particularly for the opportunity we have as Christians to talk about issues of race and ethnicity and the difficulties we've been encountering with them in our country. But God, we do so as Christians with hope, because we know that you are a God that longs to see every tongue, tribe, and nation worship you, gathered around your throne. We also know you are a God that is healing everything that is broken in this creation. And so we ask that this conversation and experience we have today and everything we do going forward in Faith and Justice would be part of your great activity of healing our broken world and reconciling all things through Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen. Okay. Well, again, welcome. My name is Dixon Kinser. I'm the rector here at St. Paul's, and really pleased to welcome you, especially if you've never been to St. Paul's. We're glad you're here. Today's conversation is about the experiences and kind of dialogue between the African-American community and law enforcement, which, as all of you know, has been something that's been in the headlines, has been the forefront of the national conversation for the last 18 months, 2 years, or going back 30 years, going back 50 years. This is sort of an ongoing conversation that seems to reemerge in particularly heated ways at certain times in our history. And so when Jocelyn, and who chairs our committee here, we were thinking about how do we have these conversations and talk about this issue in a Faith and Justice luncheon. Immediately we started thinking about people that we knew, and we started thinking about it would be interesting to hear the perspectives of people we knew. And so John Lewis was someone that came to mind, because John works here and is a friend of ours, and we were excited. And then, actually, Mark, I'm not sure how you got in the mix. Mark and Corey know each other at Crisis Control. Mark is also in the diaconal ordination process at St. and interning at St. Anne's, where Lawrence Womack, hi Lawrence, is the rector. And so we had all these great connections, and when we got them together, the first thing that we did when we started to think about what this might look like was we just let the two of them talk, and in the course of that conversation, sort of saw this beautiful sense of engagement and truth and beauty start to emerge from the conversation. And it occurred to us that the way that we should have this conversation might be different than the way it has been had and gets had in public. There are a lot of ways that we have conversations about race, ethnicity, power, institutional sin, all that in the public sphere. It's something that gets dominated usually by politicos and media personalities, right? The people that set the terms of the debate are folks that are paid talkers, folks that are good at one-liners, folks that have a bent and are positing a conversation a particular way, but also are folks that tend to lead this conversation into the realm of debate. Public conversation becomes about debate, whether it's on TV, in the newspaper, certainly on the internet, right? And so the church is a different kind of political space. It is a different kind of a community. As the church, we are doing something different in our public gatherings than anybody else is. And so when we thought, well, what would it mean for Christians to have this conversation? How would Christians begin to talk about this and sort of skirt some of these dynamics of debate? A theologian named Rebecca S. Chapp gave us some insight. And what Chapp noted was that while public discourse, especially in our country, at its worst turns into vitriolic debate, rock 'em, sock 'em robots, you're trying to punch somebody down, win an argument. The alternative in the church would be testimony. It would be about listening to stories. It would be about people sharing, this has been my experience, and then someone else listening to that experience. And the more I thought about that and the more we discussed that, we realized there couldn't be a better way to get into this conversation than to start with some storytelling. Because if you think about it, the way that you have probably most had your heart stirred or your mind changed in good ways hasn't come when someone pinned you down on a debate and you couldn't get out of it. It was when you heard someone's story. It's when you met someone. It's when somebody connected with you personally and you thought, ooh, if that was their experience, I wonder how that affects my experience and what God would be doing in them, the way God might be working in me. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to let Mark and John tell their stories. And we are all going to be listeners. So we're not going to have a time at the end of this for question and answer. We're not going to have a debate. We're not going to invite responses. We're going to listen. And we're going to let this be, first, in its first utterance today, a place of testimony. Now, it's going to be a little bit of a curated conversation. We're not going to let them just sort of talk about sports or something. Like, we've got a topic. Although, John Lewis would love that. Oh, maybe not. I don't know. Wake Forest football? Okay. Even, okay, they're 2-1. You know what? They're 2-1. This is your day. We should talk about Wake Forest football. Maybe next month's lunch. So what we're going to do is Corey, who's director of philanthropy at Crisis Control, and you might not know it to look at him, an ordained Methodist minister. Corey is going to sort of moderate this conversation, steer it a couple of places if he hears something that's interesting to listen to. We're going to watch a little bit of a video from that McKinney, Texas pool incident, and that was something that when we met and that came up as something that was really interesting, the way each of them had a different response to it. So I invite you to listen while we're here and to engage with what you're hearing through your listening, but remembering that because we're Christians, when we say listening, we're talking about holy listening, and we're talking about the kind of listening that God does. Because when God hears things in the scriptures, it moves God to act. So this is not going to be passive listening, per se. We're going to be listening with the expectation that hearts might be stirred, things might be changed, we might be emboldened to courageous action somehow, but it's all going to start with listening. What's going to help us at the end of this is we're going to pass out some papers, they may actually already be in front of you, and some pens and pencils, and we're going to invite everyone to write down two questions that they have leaving this place, and that's going to help us. That'll be a little bit of response time. It'll help the committee think about where we might go next. What would conversation number two look like? So, any questions about that? Splendid. Well, without further ado, then, I'm going to turn it over to Corey, who's going to lead us into our time.
Thank you, Dixon. Well, we are very excited that this day is here and this opportunity is here, and I don't want to spend too much time and not just getting straight to it, but I did want to give a little mention to Pope Francis, wonderful Pope that a lot of us admire quite a bit. He's visiting, he's here in the U.S., and you probably have heard some of his comments, and there was a little quote from an article in CNN that I happened to see just before I came here today that I think illuminates a little bit of what we're about today, and it's about immigration, but here's what he says. He said, "We must view each other as persons, seeing their faces and listening to their stories, trying to respond as best as we can to the situation." And I think it's just a reiteration that when we know that issues are issues, but people are people. And so when we see each other and hear each other, there's power to that. So what I want to do is introduce John Lewis to many of you. You know him quite well, but maybe I'll share something that you don't know about him. But John has been on staff at St. Paul's for 9 years. He's our building and ground supervisor. He's a North Carolina native. He attended college locally here at Wake Forest. He played football there. And he continued his football career professionally for 5 years in the Arena League. I didn't know if you knew that. He played for Greensboro, Winston-Salem, and Myrtle Beach teams. And his focus on fitness has continued with his work as a professional trainer this past 12 years. And then Mark Davidson has worked for the State Highway Patrol for a little over 24 years. He retired at the rank of sergeant. He was stationed in Salisbury, Newton, and Winston here in Winston-Salem. He spent 4 years in the Marine Corps prior to that. And although he was born in Washington, D.C., he is basically a Winston-Salem native. And in the Episcopal Church, as Dixon mentioned, he is in the second year of the formation process to be ordained vocational deacon. And his home parish is St. Clements. Shout out to St. Clements, Jamie. Thank you. All right, so I know both of these gentlemen personally. I admire them both greatly and really respect them for being here and look forward to their comments. So I'll invite Mark to go ahead and start.
Can you hear me? Okay. Okay. Well, I've prepared some comments for this afternoon to try to keep on our schedule, because I know Corey has this certain time allotted for each of us. So, and I will read from my prepared comments, if you'll allow me. I can only speak to this topic from my personal understanding, and obviously, I do not know what it's like to be an African-American male or a person of minority heritage. I do not know what it's like to be profiled or perceive that I have been profiled, and I am sure that throughout my life, my appearance has provided me with acceptance or inclusion without my even thinking about it. I'm aware that I need to acknowledge this and keep this in mind when considering our current social strife. I do have some experience with understanding the current problem from the law enforcement side, and I can only really speak credibly from that side of the issue. Well, what could be done from that side to mitigate the tension and the division in society? We might look at it first from a police training standpoint. Maybe the problem is not so much with our techniques as with the way we teach them and the words we use and the attitudes we present while relaying our information. An example might be a defensive tactics classes or a defensive tactics class. Many of the sessions I remember all included an I'm number one perspective. That is to say, I am the most important person at this citizen contact, and it is paramount that I go home today. Is this correct? Or is this part of our problem? I've heard it said many times in training, the most important thing is that you go home at the end of your shift. It sounds reasonable. The one instructing the training is trying to take care of his students to protect them, which is an honorable endeavor for sure. But would our societal relations change if we took the opposing view? You are number one. You have committed a crime, and I need to protect others from any harm they might incur as a result of your actions. But you are number one, and I need to be mindful of that in my work. What if a defensive tactics instructor training a new class of recruits, instead of saying you are number one, and all that matters is that you go home at the end of your shift, said, you are taking the job of a police officer. Think about this very deeply. You're asking to become a servant to society. This may cost you your life. Are you ready to give up your life? You may hesitate at some point in the course of your duty, and maybe for good reason, for compassion or empathy for another, and this could cost you your life. If this happens, we will not fault you, we will not belittle your reasoning, we will honor your selfless action and your decision. I assent to the golden rule, treat others as you would like to be treated. I agree with this on Sunday morning, but how can this apply the rest of the week, particularly in my job as a police officer, when others are trying to hurt me and to hurt others? What if Jesus had taken the stance, I need to go home at the end of the day at all costs? Have we not learned what he was doing here among us was showing us the way, the true and sacrificial way to live? I'm reminded of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's famous quote from The Cost of Discipleship. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. This certainly applies in a figurative sense, as with dying to ourselves, our self-image, or our ego, but it may also apply literally, as in Bonhoeffer's own case. Throughout my time in the Marine Corps and my career on the Highway Patrol, I constantly heard the statement, "We are the best fighting force, the best law enforcement agency." Today, we hear frequently this same statement with regard to the United States. We are the best. We are the greatest nation on the earth. And I'm sure I've even said this at some point in my life. But deep down, I always questioned it. Did I really believe this? Maybe I overthink things a bit. But I looked around at many things that I knew could be done better and thought, you know, we probably are not really the best at this. Surely there's someone better. Not to mention, I witnessed practices from other agencies and units that I knew were better. So when we pound this into people's heads, especially young, impressionable people, all it does is encourage a false egotistic superiority, which too many times leads to confrontation and tragedy. If we said more realistically, something like, we stand together, not perfect, but together, helping one another to improve. This, in my view, would be a more honest statement. This past January, I had the opportunity to attend the Martin Luther King holiday events in Winston-Salem. As part of that day's events, there was a panel discussion similar to the one we're having today. Toward the end of that event, an elderly African-American gentleman from the audience spoke to the panel. He related his fear of white police officers getting behind or near his vehicle when he was driving. His words made a profound impression on me. I've heard these concerns before, but for some reason with this gentleman, you could hear the sincerity in the inflection of his voice and see it in his body language as he stood before the panel. I do not have any personal experience with racial profiling, and I did not practice that in my time in law enforcement, nor did I knowingly observe it from those I worked with. However, I would not deny that it exists. There are too many personal stories to the contrary, and I believe John Lewis can speak to that topic better than I, so I will yield to his comments.
Can you hear me? Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming out. I appreciate seeing all the faces that are here, because obviously y'all are very intrigued and interested in this topic. And again, thank you. Speaking personally, I can tell you about two different scenarios about being profiled. The first one, I was coming up Cherry Street, going towards Lawrence Jones Coliseum. I think I was driving maybe 35, 40. 45, 50, you never know. And all of a sudden, this car just came up right beside me. And it came up to right beside me and just started riding the same, pretty much the same speed I was. I slowed down. The car slowed down. I speeded back up. The car speeded back up. I said, what's going on? So it came to a stoplight. I stopped. The car stopped, and I looked over. I rolled my window down. I looked at the person. It was a white guy. So I asked him, is something wrong? Something's going on. He was like, no. I take off. 2 miles later, I get stopped by a cop. I'm like, what's going on? They got a call saying that I had, pretty much had a gun at the person that was going back and forth playing with me on the road. So I got searched for no apparent reason. Based on somebody calling them, telling a lie, and being that who I was, I think 4 or 5 cops came up to me to go through my truck. It took the 5th cop, who I was a trainer with, who I used to work. I used to be a personal trainer at Peak Fitness, and the last cop who pulled up used to come work out there, so he knew me very well. So once he pulled up, he realized who I was. He was like, "What's going on, John?" I'm like, "Man, I'm being falsely accused of having a gun."
pointing at somebody who was right beside me, and I didn't do nothing at all. But by him calling in and telling on me, they just took off with it. They just assumed that I had a gun. They went through my truck, up and down, in and out, like even basically they didn't believe nothing I said. So I mean, it bothered me. It really got to me. I mean, I understand, Tommy, you know, the golden rule, treat others as you want to be treated, but it's not that way at all. It hasn't been that way since I can remember, okay? Second scenario, I'm at Wake Forest. Me and two of my teammates, walking on the quad, see this white lady. She was sitting on the steps, she was drunk, she was crying. Went over to see what was going on with her. She started yelling and screaming, like, don't hurt me. Y'all gonna rape me, you gonna hurt me. I'm like, no, we trying to find out what's going on with you. So one of my teammates called the security, campus security. As soon as the campus security get there, they start questioning us, like, what did we do to the lady? And we was there to help her because she was there by herself at night, crying. But yet we got blamed from it for no particular reason. So I'm trying to understand the logic of, like, as soon as you see the skin, it's like a light switch is turned on, like, okay, since, you know, he's black, he gotta be the person that's creating the problem. And I'm trying to understand why is that always the case. And I understand, I heard what you said, are you ready to give up your life? I mean, when it comes to living, this day and age, living is hard as it is. But always have your head on a swivel, especially if you got you driving down the street and you see a cop behind you. It's like you said, fear comes into our mind because we know 9 times out of 10 we're going to get stopped for no apparent reason. Because it has happened to me before as well. And I try my best to go by the golden rule, treat other people as you want to be treated. But it's not being reciprocated at all. It's really not. Okay?
Well, as our Faith and Justice Committee had discussions about this issue, it seemed that more and more instances were coming up this past summer. So we had our first conversation, I think, in May or even April, and just seemed that more and more progressively, it just seemed to be an epidemic of these situations that would come about, and we'd hear them. In this day and age, you hear about everything instantly, but we see videos and the like, and none was really more disturbing than that which took place in McKinney, Texas. And you probably have seen this video before, but it was an end-of-the-year pool party going on, and in the midst of that, some invited African-American students were treated rudely, and the police were called. And so we're going to watch 3 minutes of this video, which was captured. And it's a 7-minute video. We're not trying to manipulate things around. Just 7 minutes is quite a while. So we're going to watch 3 minutes of the video, and then I'm going to ask John and Mark to give some comments.
Yo, Richard, what color was it?
It's navy blue.
I know where it is.
That's a baby. Right now, you're staying. Y'all make me fucking run around here with 30 pounds of goddamn gear on the sun because you want to screw around out here? Y'all keep standing here and run your mouths. You're going to go too. Get out of here. I already told you. I don't care. Leave. You're leaving now. You're leaving now. You are leaving now. Leave. That way.
Don't talk shit.
Get your ass gone.
You don't matter.
Get running in your mouth.
Oh, my God.
Leave.
Oh, my God.
All right. You know what? All right, come on.
Yo, Jumper, what the fuck is going on? Why is he acting so crazy?
Oh my God!
You don't have to go!
y'all filming. Y'all filming, okay? But you chill out.
He pulled out his gun on her.
Get out of here or you're going too.
Adrian, you good, bro?
Yeah, now, bud.
Adrian.
Hey, I'm going to tell you one more time. Get your ass out of here. Y'all get across the street.
Adrian. Across the street, you're going too. Adrian.
Those two weren't my cousins. Told you to get on the ground and stay, didn't you? And what did you do when I walked away? So you just did what everybody else did. And what everybody else did was illegal. You did it and you got caught. They didn't. Now you're sitting here paying for it.
We just came in from right there.
I don't have a problem. That's not my problem. I asked y'all to sit. You became a part of the mob. You could have been the guys that were doing right. And you weren't, so now you're sitting here in trouble.
We can go get our friends.
You're gonna sit here until we get this figured out.
Hey guys.
Well, I knew how much time we had it allotted for, and I just wanted to move on. That's hard to watch. All right, let's just like to invite some comments. We'll ask John first to kind of share his thoughts.
I think the guy that was recording all that, wasn't he white?
If I'm not mistaken, the guy that was recording all that, he was a white guy. And you notice he was walking back and forth the whole time recording that, but the cop never touched him, never grabbed him, or nothing like that. Nothing like that. So I'm trying to understand. And the lady that he pushed down like that, basically what she did was absolutely positively nothing. What was she doing? I'm trying to understand, what was she doing to deserve what she got? I need help with that. I truly need help with that.
Okay, thanks. Mark?
Yeah, what I see when I first watched this, when I learned of it several months back, is someone who is overwhelmed, someone who's scared, someone that's run into something that's larger than them that they cannot handle and realizes this and then starts and then kind of degenerates into knee-jerk reactions that have nothing to do with any type of policies or trainings. Because one of the things I noticed when I watched it was if there's three or four police officers you see in there, he's the only one with the stripes on his shoulder. So he's in charge out there. And those men are looking at him to get a handle on that situation. And whether or not they, I mean, probably they are, maybe some of them are. I mean, I don't know the guys personally, but he feels that. They're looking to me, I've got to get a handle on this. And he cannot handle it. It's larger than him. They need more help, or they need to just pull back at that point and do something different. I don't know that he ever tried to encounter the person that the call was made on. You know, I think that it started out of a fight in the neighborhood between two people in the neighborhood, and then they were called. But from the time you pick up with this, it's just, it's out of control. So that would be the first place to go, would be where the initial call, you know, who the initial call was made on, and try to negotiate with those parties or talk to those parties and resolve something, you know. But you don't see any of that in this. And I think a lot of it is fear and on the part of the man we see that's so out of control and his own... I guess he's dealing with his own personal inadequacy at that too. And I think he, if I read somewhere, he's also an instructor, an academy instructor, and he may have a reputation within the law enforcement community there as, you know, being somebody that's got it all together, that knows all the, you know, how to handle everything, and maybe he feels like he's that man. And then when he runs into this situation that he can't handle and he can't affect, and it is degenerating right there in front of his face, he does things like pulling out his gun. I don't think he intends to shoot anybody. He's doing that as an act of desperation to try to get those folks to comply. Well, if I pull out my gun, maybe everybody will just do what I say. I think it's a last-ditch effort type of thing. I mean, it's certainly not warranted in that situation to pull out his gun, but I don't think he pulls it out to shoot anybody. I think one of the other police officers actually puts his hand on his shoulder, and to me that says, hold up here when the gun comes out. I hope that's what that means. We don't need to go there. I mean, you know, but that's kind of what I saw there. I think when he, probably the next day when he looked at this, he thought, who is that guy? Who's that guy? You know, when the dust settled, because I believe I'm correct, and he resigned from the police department maybe 2 or 3 days after this occurred, I think he realized, you know, I don't have a place here anymore, you know, and wisely resigned. So it's unfortunate and it's terrible to see that.
Yeah, John.
You had made a comment before, and we talked about this before too, about him being scared. Mm-hmm. I said, we talked about this previously, about him being scared, him showing fear. Mm-hmm. And I had made a comment before to him before. The guy with the gun is the one who's scared.
I know, it doesn't make any sense.
It makes no sense whatsoever, sir.
I understand what you're saying, but that's what I see. And since we're talking from personal perspective, he's afraid, even though you say, well, how can a man that's got a gun there and all the power be the one that's afraid? But I would feel pretty darn confident in telling you he's got fear in him, too.
And not to mention, too, most of the people that was there were teenagers at a pool party. Mm-hmm. And yet, to threaten them, he felt like he needed to pull the gun out to gain control?
Well, like I said, it's a knee-jerk reaction. He doesn't know what else to do. Nobody's doing what he says. No, the whole thing is chaos, and he's trying whatever he can think of, being thought through very thoroughly or deeply. What he's doing, he's just reacting, trying to get something to affect the situation.
Right.
And it continues to degenerate.
Gotcha. So you say chaos. Mm-hmm. So when it gets out of control, the gun comes out.
Well, it did here.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, and we can also say, too, I mean, it's just, I think we have to all say that there's no excuse for anything that went on for that day. I mean, the repercussions that have to be accepted for whatever, and trying to explain it does give some help to recognize.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm not taking up for him. I was asked to kind of give my perspective on this, and that's kind of my perspective. I'm not saying what he did was right. I'm just saying I think these are some things that were going on mentally and emotionally within him when this whole thing's unfolding.
Well, and based on your understanding of training and that kind of thing, and tactics. And
he certainly didn't stick to any of that. And when that fear and inadequacy overwhelmed him, then he just started doing whatever. And then the profanity came out, and, you know, and he was shook up.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's never an excuse, but, you know, the nuance of the day, what led up to that point in the day for him, again, no excuse, but a couple suicide calls in the day and the stress that people are into doesn't excuse anything, but it just, there's a lot of, and you know what, there's this nuance to every situation, but there's no excuse for that kind of behavior. And I think part of the reason he resigned, frankly, is because the pressure that was not, I mean, maybe it was his own decision, but it was also a community decision to, this is the right thing to do, for sure. Okay. So now let's remove ourselves from the video. And again, I know it's powerful and it's intense, and the idea is not to just crank things up, but more to just talk about some general questions for each of you. And either one can answer this one first. So how does your Christian faith affect how you deal with the issue of racial discrimination?
It's sometimes for me, it's hard to turn the other cheek. It's very hard. Because when you turn the other cheek, like I said to you before, that cheek's getting slapped upon, get hit upon. So it's like, it's tough. The more you're trying to forgive, more stuff is keep occurring. This past year, it's been something special. Every week, if not every other day, something's in the newspaper or in the news referring to police and the black community. It's just tough.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is a large problem from a Christian standpoint, we've got to get past the retribution aspect in this, the retributive justice thing. You do this to me, I want to do that to you. You do this to me. And somehow we've got to make time for one another and see one another as people. And you know, probably maybe more of this is incumbent on the white population than the black population. But we've got to get out of the tit for tat struggle that we're in. I was watching CNN the other day, and one of the anchors, or no, it wasn't CNN, it was Fox News, and one of the anchors was talking to a gentleman who's the one of the leaders in the Black Lives Matter movement, and she was trying to get him to recant from a certain position using some information or that was said by another party, but she's trying to prove her point. He is not going to bend on his point and won't agree with what you, and it's just pretty much you can't hear anything after a while for all the shouting back and forth. And somehow we've got to get through that and be able to listen to one another and not have to retaliate. I know, you know, from the I mean, like I said when in my opening comments, I don't have personal experience in the African American community, but I know that there's it's got to be hard when somebody tells you, you know, we have to hold back and not retaliate. But I think that's the only way forward for both the black community and the white community. And we've got to see people. I don't want to take up all the time, Corey, but I was, when I looked at this video the other day in preparation to come here, there was another video that I looked at and where a white officer had stopped some black gentlemen in a vehicle, and pretty much when he came to the window on the stop, you know, they just vented on him. He stood there, he said his position, and they vented some more, and they were taking video from inside the car. And the title, and the gentleman that was driving had, you know, had felt much like you do, that he had been profiled and had a lot of problem with what was going on, and so he spoke at great length on that video. And the title of that video was "Cop Gets Schooled by Black Driver," or something like that, something to that effect. "Cop Gets Told." Well, just that sense there, that here's a video, whoever posted that, here's a video that shows him getting his, you know, that he gets schooled. I mean, we got to get past that, I think, that, you know, I've got to show you up mentality. But that's, in society today, that seems to be where we go all the time. One up.
One thing I can also say that it's not just personal, it's generational, because it's been going on decades.
I would agree.
So it's when you see it over and over again, year after year, decade after decade, it gets tougher and tougher. Mm-hmm. You're really trying to sit back and try to understand from their perspective, because the end result, 9 times out of 10, getting arrested, getting brutal, and you're going to jail.
And let me follow up with that too. So we need influences in our lives that can make a difference. So who, for each of you, who's someone in your life who has been the strongest influence you to fight against racial discrimination?
G.O.D.
Well, I would say you and I agree wholeheartedly on that answer. That's, I mean, it's an understanding that I have come to. That it's wrong. I've seen it in my life too, but it's extremely wrong, and we need to work to dismantle racism and to do what we can to rectify this problem. And I, if I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be sitting here in front of all of you, and I know John wouldn't either.
All right. All right, guys. Well, I'll have Dixon come back up here to close us. So I just want to thank you very much for, there's much more to be said, and this is just, it's impossible to cover it all, but we are grateful for your sharing and your willingness to be vulnerable in this situation. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a high wire act, guys. Thank you. Thank you. I don't think any of us would want to sit up here and just off the cuff talk about our experience the way you have. Thank you so much. And we also recognize the awkward position both of you end up in as like the sole representative of all of law enforcement, the entire African-American experience and community. We're limited. We're doing what we can. But thank you both for your honesty. Thank you all for listening so much. And I know we could go further and say more, and we want to, but we want to help figuring out what are the right ways to move forward, what are the next conversations to have. If you don't mind, on your pieces of paper, could you write down one or two questions that you now have? And I'll add to that also, maybe if there's something you want to know more about. I heard someone say this, I want to know more about that. I'd like to hear more about this experience, or what was that? Say more about this. If anything like that, if you would just jot those down on those pieces of paper, and then Jocelyn, how are we collecting those papers? Well, so we'll have someone collect them on your way out, and I suppose if you need to slip out and don't have a piece of paper, if you need a piece of paper or a pencil, raise your hand and we'll have someone get it to you. Okay, we got a couple, Jeannie up here, just a couple. So our next two gatherings are going to be October 22nd and November 19th. So mark your calendars. We'll have flyers and things up as well, but they will be reflective of what comes out of these slips of paper and this conversation we've had. We'll probably debrief with Mark and John a little bit. And I want to invite this to close while people are writing things down. We just scratched the surface. We just broached the topic. And you feel how much tension there is in it, how complicated it is. And if you're like me, you feel the frustration and sometimes the hopelessness of it. I don't know if you ever feel like that, and that can lead pretty quickly to cynicism. It's never going to get better. How are we ever going to fix this? There's no way things get healed. This couldn't. What are we even doing here? Isn't this just an exercise? Could things really be changed through this? The unique Christian witness in this is that we think, oh yeah, things can be different. Things can actually change. This kind of conversation, 30 minutes in a video of conversation, can make a difference. It impacts the things because we have a God that we believe is healing the world and is putting the shards of racial discrimination, segregation, racism, is putting those pieces back together and healing them. And that's what we profess that and believe that strongly, and that's why we're doing this. So my encouragement would be the places that you feel stirred, frustrated, even inspired, let them be a call to prayer. If you are a Christian and you're here as a person of faith, let them inspire your prayer, because the promise of our God is that God will be in that tension with you. And I think with that, I will say amen. And thank you for coming.